Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and today's conversation is with Amy Comstock, Director of the Office of Government Ethics. Well, Amy, in our last segment, you talked about new legislation that you're developing, and you described some of the characters. Could you give us a little more insight into the legislation?
One of the things I mentioned is that there has been a sense, and I agree with it, that the nominations process and the financial disclosure, public financial disclosure process, has become too burdensome. I'm focusing primarily on the financial disclosure aspect of that. The information that we've required for the last 20 years for public financial disclosure is actually quite detailed. And as a result of the Presidential Transition Act legislation that was enacted last fall, OGE was asked to do a study to see if that process could be streamlined. Quite basically, what we did was go in with the mandate that we were not going to lessen our or ethics officials' ability to assess conflicts at all. But we went in with the mission that after 20 years of experience, is there information that we receive from that form that is either never used, useless, redundant. So we just went through with that, those questions in mind, and as a result, we're able to propose legislation that really eliminates a lot of the, I would call, unnecessary information that we accept on the form. For example, currently, if someone comes from a private corporation and they're coming into the government, they have to list on the form the exact dollar figure of their salary from the prior corporation. Quite frankly, it doesn't matter what that dollar figure is. It will not change the fact that they should have a one-year cooling off period from their corporation and any official decision making they make, unless they receive a waiver. And if they own stock in the corporation, it will be a conflict. It doesn't, someone has to actually go through the, take the time to get the exact dollar figure written down on the form. We've proposed to eliminate that requirement. In addition, the current form has 11 different categories for the range, the value of an asset you hold. And this is the most significant change that we're proposing. Currently, you have to, if you own stock in that tire corporation again, you have to check in a range if it's worth between, I think it's $15,000 and $50,000, between $100,000 and $250,000, but with certain limits. If that asset is worth maybe $50,000 or $250,000, there is a conflict. It actually doesn't matter to assess a conflict how the exact value of that asset. But especially for people who have any significant assets at all, the amount of the hours it takes to go through and determine the exact value of all their assets is phenomenal. We've been able to eliminate the 11 categories of, or propose eliminating the 11 categories of value and reduce it to 3. I could go through all these, and I don't think our listeners want to hear all the details of all of them, but the fact is that if these proposals are enacted, we will be able to reduce hours and hours the amount of time it takes to fill out this form, but we firmly believe not impede at all an ethics official's or the public's ability to determine whether someone has a conflict and assess integrity in decision making.
Well, earlier you mentioned that you're in fact a political appointee yourself. Do you have any suggestions or lessons learned for those nominees who are currently involved in the process?
Well, be patient, I think, would be the most important guidance. Answer all questions you're asked fully, but most importantly, hang in there because it's worth the wait. From my own experience, as well as from some surveys that I've read, a position as a presidential appointee, a Senate-confirmed position, according to a Presidential Appointee Initiative survey, the vast majority of people who have held those jobs would recommend it to a friend. It's just a wonderful opportunity for public service and to really work on issues and matters that are important to the country, and I think it is definitely worth the wait.
Well, let's shift a little bit in terms of talking now about managing OGE. What are the strategic priorities for OGE for the year?
Paul, obviously the number one priority will be to do anything we need to do to ensure the passage of the legislation that we've just talked about. I'm hopeful that it will go through. We sent it up in July, and it should be introduced in the fall. It is nonpartisan good government legislation, and I'm hoping it will go through. But keeping my fingers crossed and assuming that that task is done because it's up on the Hill and will be successful, I am now committed to starting a review of the criminal conflict of interest statutes. We haven't really talked talked about that, but this criminal statutes that underlie the need for financial disclosure cover the areas of conflict of interest, post-employment, and issues of, for example, representations a federal employee can make to other agencies on behalf of outside organizations, volunteer activities, that kind of thing. These statutes are very broad. They need a lot of modernization. Some of the activities that are actually criminal under these statutes, in my mind, should not be criminal and are not even intuitively wrong. This is an area that I'm very committed to working with the Department of Justice to see what proposals we can come up with to revise these statutes. The criminal conflict of interest is obviously the main topic today, and there are some areas, I think, where that statute is very broad, and the most educated person in terms of government ethics training still can be surprised sometimes when I say, no, that would be considered a conflict and you need to be careful and stay out of that.
What process does OGE go through to choose the strategic priorities?
Obviously, I'm a firm believer in team management, and we work as a – I have some excellent, excellent deputy directors, and we work as a team to focus on the issues that we think are priorities for the next year or two. I have a 5-year term, and so I have 4 more years within that term. I also look very closely and take very seriously the issues that are raised with me by the ethics officials in the agencies in terms of the problems that they're seeing or the issues that arise when they deal directly with the clients. We haven't talked about that in great detail, but every department in the federal government and agency has a designated agency ethics official. They're the people who bring to life, if you will, the programs and regulations and policies that are set by our office. They are each tasked with the responsibility of overseeing the ethics program within that agency. It's really a, at least in hindsight, brilliant structure because it allows each department and agency to have someone who can tailor the ethics program within that agency to the needs of that agency. For example, the ethics issues that might arise at the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, could be very different than the ethics issues that would arise at the Department of Education. And so it's very important for those DAOs that we call them, to be able to tailor the ethics rules to the needs of their clients.
What role does OGE have in terms of evaluating the successes of those different programs, those ethics programs?
It's our responsibility to oversee those programs. Under the statute, we're called the Supervising Ethics Office, so that if particular issues arise, it is our responsibility to follow up and ensure that that agency is responding to that issue, to ensuring that that issue is dealt with properly. And unfortunately, issues do arise occasionally. And we keep in fairly close contact with the DAOs and the sense of we have regular written guidance. Obviously, a number of the DAOs at the larger departments we speak with personally on a fairly regular basis. We have other communication tools that we use. Once a year, we have an annual conference of between 400 and 500 ethics officials who come together to talk about the hot ethics topics of the year. But in addition, we every 4 years audit the ethics program of every agency and department. We send out a team of staff from our office who will go and look at various aspects of the ethics program at each agency, and always they walk away with some recommendations because obviously everything always could use a little improvement or tweaking. But that's the process we use to ensure that the fundamental components of a program are in place.
What does a successful ethics program look like? How do you measure it?
A successful ethics program, in terms of the components that the law requires, would include a financial disclosure system, obviously, that is being monitored, the forms are being reviewed carefully in a timely manner. It also includes a training component, which we haven't really discussed, but at the highest levels, federal employees, all those who file these public financial disclosure forms, are required to receive ethics training once a year, and a strong ethics program includes a training component. And these are all things that we can measure. The fact is, though, that the best ethics program is one that is used by employees, where employees will reach out to ethics officials and ask their questions. They receive answers that are workable for that agency. It's very important to me as a leader and in terms of the mission of OGE to ensure that our program is not just a standalone bureaucratic program. We need to be able to give guidance that is integrated well with the mission and the programs of an agency. And that's much harder to measure, but counseling in a really strong program, whenever we've seen a really strong program, it has a very strong counseling component. Now, when you step back, the bigger picture, how do we know if the ethics program for the whole executive branch is successful? I don't really know, and that's what I meant if someone knew the answer. If an ethics official is getting an increase in calls, does that mean people understand the issues more and are calling more? Or does that mean they didn't learn a thing in training? They're totally confused and they're calling with questions. If the calls stop, does that mean they learned all the answers or they don't care about the issues? I don't know how to measure that.
Okay, and that's a good breaking point. Come back with us after the break and we'll find out what the future of government ethics might look like. Will all this technology be an advantage or a disadvantage? This is the Business of Government Hour.